Welcome once more to Back to the Future. My name is Martin Raymond, and this week we're talking to brand executive, author of The Business of Aspiration, and one of Forbes' most influential CMOs, Anna Angelic. Anna, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for a wonderful introduction, and thanks for having me. I'm excited for our conversation.
A real pleasure. And I also just want to remind people that as well as being one of the great CMOs, you're also internationally known as a strategist in your own right. You have a doctorate in sociology, which I think probably explains the depth and I guess unusual insights I found in your book, The Business of Aspiration. I just wonder if we could start off by giving us some glimpses as to what kind of things I'm likely to find as an aspirational CEO in your latest book.
Yes. So the title of the book has two keywords. One is the business and the other is inspiration. And the book is about how brands can capitalize on the changing status symbols, changing consumer status symbols. So how we spend our time and money and what we aspire to be, do, identify with and follow changes brand strategy. So that was the reason I wanted to connect trends that are happening, not trends, but say undercurrents or shifting cultural symbols, shifting social symbols, and shifting ways that people distinguish themselves from others.
Excellent.
So, yeah, go ahead.
You have a subtitle in the book, which is that whole notion of, as you say, how social, cultural, and environmental capital changes brands. And I'm just wondering if you could talk for a moment about how you define environmental capital in the way that you've looked at it in the book.
Yes, capital is something that can be tangible and intangible. Obviously, we all know economic capital. When we talk about social capital, that's the size of our network, the strength of our connections, our reputation, and so on. When it comes to your question, environmental capital, that refers how brands operate, how companies operate, and what is their environmental footprint. So the less footprint, the higher the capital, if you will. So if you think of an example of Patagonia or Veja sneakers, you say, hey, transparent practices accrues a lot of environmental capital as perceived and calculated and evaluated by consumers.
Ah, now, because this is kind of leads me, I guess, to my next question, because of the whole nature of, you know, the book, you talk about aspiration. And I think, everybody is familiar with, for example, the experience economy. But one of the things I found fascinating about your book was how you, A, introduced the notion of the aspiration economy and how I guess you see aspiration impacting on the way both we as consumers speak to brands, but also how brands really need to think about talking to consumers in the future.
Yes, absolutely. And in my book, I looked more. So the book is structured as a very practical guide. Yes, there are insights, sociological insights, ecological, anthropological, cultural. But at the end of the day, it's like, what does that mean for brands? Is that question of so what? So what I did there is really showed how the traditional ways of creating and exchanging value, which means I make products and services and people exchange them for money, are not relevant anymore, are not the only way that brands and consumers interact. So when you think about what has happened since my book was published and how in fashion, NFTs and virtual worlds and blockchain has exploded. That's exactly, not just in fashion, in art as well. That's exactly what I'm talking about. How do you ascribe value to an NFT? there are like drawings that go for $400,000. So how do you participate in that calculation and how do you even understand it? That is where I was going with that. When you look like the kinds of capital that people have, now they can translate it into new forms of value and exchange those forms of value. That is not what our economy is based on.
Yeah, so I found this fascinating because, you know, I think traditionally, to your point, you know, we looked at wealth and status and how we measure that as a value. And then I think we went on to, you know, the notion of discernment and heritage and, you know, I think increasingly purpose as a value. And I was fascinated to see that you had taken that almost a stage further and were asking questions about how things like community, for example, you know, increase the value of a brand, how creativity, how the notion of the creator or the curator brand always uplifted the brand in a different way. I'm just wondering if you can kind of talk to us a bit more about these new values that you were subscribing or ascribing rather to brands.
Absolutely. And that goes to four C's, which is this methodology that I developed, which is content, community, curation, and collaborations as new ways for brands to create value and also as new fundamentals of branding. Before it was like, okay, let's create a logo, color palette, and then we do communication and campaigns and so on. And now, and we, which is, you know, like, it's still, all these forms coexist, and that's what makes this exciting. And what I have been noticing and what I have been studying and working on and in my professional life is really how as a brand you create different forms of capital and different forms of currency. So you have brands that have strong communities, and then you have people who gravitate to those brands because of their community.
Yeah.
So they don't even buy brands' products. But there is, the brand is still valuable because it has fans before it has customers.
See, fascinating. Because I find, again, you know, when I still speak to brands, and I work quite a lot, as you do, with kind of, you know, the big luxury conglomerates, they still attach value to weight or a presence, where you're actually attaching this value to a culture or an ability to create or a way to create community. Do you think that brands have really understood that, or are they still struggling with these concepts?
There are brands who understand it incredibly well, especially, and I'll give you some examples. At the same time, those brands really understand that their audience is not their customers only. Their audience is cultural observers, those who are making culture, participating in culture, streetwear enthusiasts, and even just those who just exist. So everyone, basically. And then you have those that are fans of a brand. So you have like Rafa Cycling, which is a great example. You have Patagonia. I'm a big fan of Patagonia, big fan. I don't own anything by Patagonia, but I consider part of Patagonia community because I identify with their values very much so. Then there is obviously Glossier, which is all about exchanging makeup tips. There is Fenty Beauty, which also has a strong community that Rihanna created by extending what the color palette, what kind of skin tones and who is allowed in beauty industry and what is considered beautiful. So you see, there are all those like very strong value systems that gather community around them.
So interesting, because when you talk about and you know the brands you mentioned and the way you describe them, you're not just describing a community, you're in some ways describing the content of the community. And I think quite a lot of brands seem to have a community, but in terms of tackling things within it, like what I call content-driven issues, you know, taking a stand, having a viewpoint, taking leadership, there still seems to be a lot of brands who are fearful of having a voice because of how that voice might adversely be read by their kind of target demographic. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I understand the sort of complexity. It's not straightforward, obviously. Yeah. At the same time, I believe that that's a non-issue for brands who are close to culture, understand culture, understand their customers, understand all those different groups, the observers, the fans, the commentators, the collaborators, and the customers, and understand what is important to their customers. And they understand also where the cultural winds are blowing, so to speak. So they're basically part of culture. They're not
I think that's fascinating, because in your book as well, you really explore that, but also you remind brands that, I guess, with those issues about the kind of the editorial nature of the conversation or how the community can have a point of view, that really the best way to identify that or explore that is to talk to these fans directly, because in some ways they are the people that are determining the conversations, or perhaps giving brands leads as to where they should be directing those points of view to over the next, say, 3, 5, 10 years.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, like, the brands don't even need to do anything. Customers are going to tell you what they think, and they tell you what they think all the time on Instagram, on TikTok, in comments, so the information is everywhere. It's like whether a brand decides to act on that insight or not, because too often there is like, oh, diversity, transparency, and then it's not reflected in behavior. Yes. And if it's not reflected in behavior, people are going to notice that, and you can't hide. It's actions, not words.
Good. See, I found the term you used about quite fascinating, because I was thinking, as you say in the book, it's easy for brands, if they listen, to identify these new shifts and trends. But one of the terms you use is you say that brands should hack them. They should kind of, tap into these zeitgeist changes and perhaps utilize them more proactively. I'm just wondering if you can talk to me a bit more about how you see brands hacking into the culture. How should they go about doing something like that?
What my premise is here, and that I explore in the book, is really before hacking grows, the brands need to hack culture first. And culture hacking means really identifying all of the existing fan groups, all of the existing conversations that are happening, and then using them as a beta testers, as the biggest fans for the brand, and piggybacking on what is happening in that group to use for brand growth, and to avoid being a theoretical Telfar Clemens, who is a fashion brand in New York. He's from Queens. He is very close to LGBTQ plus community, and he's been around for more than a decade. In 2017, got CFDA award, which allowed him to pioneer Telfar bag. So why is that relevant as a case study? This is the brand that is like, he is a DJ. He is part of his own customers. And everything that he does, he refused to go to Met Gala because he doesn't want to be part of a fashion system. But he launched Telfar TV. He reinvented the way, democratic way, that people can have access to his bags by pre-ordering them. That is hacking culture to hack growth. That is the best example. Hacking culture means being part of the community that reflects the values your brand reflects, and growing from there.
Yeah, you see, I found this because I had just before we came on air, I was having a chat with somebody who is, I guess, would be described as a chief marketing officer at one of the big social media brands. And what I found fascinating is that they didn't see marketing as something that was proactive. They saw it as something that was reflective on things that were happening in the culture. And I think what you're describing there is a much more proactive, strategic, engaging way about not just hacking the culture, but really, I guess, plugging into the conversations that people are having, so that you are riding with them rather than working against them. And when I kind of was thinking about this, for a lot of people in marketing, I'm not sure that they understand that difference between, you know, reflecting on what consumers want versus what you're saying here is it's potentially brilliant and even better by plugging into knowing what they want and then taking them a step further along in that conversation.
It is definitely that, but it's more also like poking culture. So like understanding really what is the mechanism, how the influence spreads, or what people are right now spending time on, or how they communicate. And also what, again, going back to the aspiration, what do they aspire to be and do, and how do they signal their status? So if you understand that, for example, that nostalgia is big, you want to go and reopen your archives. If you want to sort of understand how you want to excite different groups of people, then that's going to change how you design and merchandise your products. So it's about creating hooks in terms of both content, both collaborations, then curation, and we talked about community. The more hooks brand has, and those hooks always need to be proactively created, as you said. You can't have like hooks in culture. You need to try different things and see how culture responds. That's what it means. For brands are not economic entities. They're not just economic entities. Right. They're also social and cultural and environmental entities.
See, I guess I'm with you on this, because I always see, you know, great brands are also great at not just creating editorial, but at reading the zeitgeist and then pulling that together in key angles and hooks that people just really can relate to. But one of the I guess the big debates currently is about how influential are, for example, social influencers. So if you think about, everybody's talking about, you know, the social influencer, talking about the creator economy, but I'm just curious to have your thoughts on that. Do you really think that social influencers are as influential as they are and claim to be, or do you think we need to have a much different lens when we're kind of examining the role and the power in promoting brands?
Well, there are different levels of social influence. So there are obviously commercial influencers, those big ones that operate as media companies. So when a brand works with those influencers, you know what you're paying, you're buying reach.
Right.
Then there are curators. So those are the ones that are more, they're bringing something in. They don't go and like, you know, on a cobblestone street and take a photo of themselves. They offer a specific angle or a specific filter to what is going on. And that filter can be in terms of looks, it can, or style or taste or music, film, you name it. And we have that happening on Depop very much so, because all consumers there are also influencers, because it really depends on the individual style and individual finds and how they put things together. So that is what really matters, and how that then influences the fashion industry is another story. But in terms of how influence spreads, they're more micro, but they're not micro influencers, they're curators. And then the third source of influence are algorithms. So algorithmic personalization on Instagram, on Facebook, on TikTok, you don't need people for that. It's like basically the Instagram feeds you on TikTok content based on the content that you already liked.
Ah, you see, so this is where I find the you know, this is constant, and I'm sure you come across this question or conversation all of the time, where people ask you, are influencers reflecting trends as they are emerging and kind of boomeranging them into the mainstream, or are they, by their claim, for example, creating trends and amplifying them and boomeranging them into the mainstream? So which one do you stand with, influencers as trend creators or influencers as people boomeranging somebody else's kind of original thoughts back into the mainstream culture?
Well, one thing is to amplify whatever is going on. So I think it's also directional influence. with what you're seeing, that before the direction of influence, for example, let's take fashion and the rest of culture. So fashion would, like, there was like a singular vision of the founder, or you know, like I don't know, specific aesthetics, and then that would trickle into culture. And now it's, when you see what Balenciaga is doing with the Simpsons or with the video game, it's actually bringing in culture at the center of the brand. So now, why is that relevant? You will, going back, you will always want to have some, mass media still exists. Non-linear TV is still a legitimate channel. So when you think about that, those jobs of those channels are to amplify. You don't go, you don't buy, you don't make a TV spot and buy media to influence, and like, you spread your message. So this is the same with influencers. And then there are those who create culture. So you can work with both. And there's sometimes, when you have Kanye West, for example, or Tyler, the Creator, or Virgil Abloh, they're both.
I think that one of the things I discovered in your book, because I sometimes muddle these things up, because you talk about influencers and you talk about curators, and you say, and I'm not quoting you directly, but sort of paraphrasing one of the chapters, where you say, you know, curators are now more important and powerful than influencers, you know, when it comes to identifying, defining, and driving trends. Can you just tell me what, you know, your definition of curators, for example, and where you would look across the metaverse or the internet to find out where curators are kind of doing their best kind of work?
They're doing it on Instagram, they're doing it on TikTok, they're doing it on Depop, they're doing it on ThreadUp, Western Collective, like any social platform, every and any social platform has excellent curators. What makes curators different from influencers is the depth of their knowledge, their passion, and their interest. They're experts in their area. They know a lot about, say, fashion from in the 60s. Or street style from the 90s, or, you know, like thing, or I don't know, specific music genre that existed for 1 minute in East London. Yeah. So they're very deeply steeped into cultural expertise. So what they're basically doing is they're connecting the dots between the present and the past. They're interpreting the present through their knowledge of the past, or their knowledge of the dynamic that happened decades ago that can be traced now. So they're mostly like archivists, collectors, and then curators, if you will. What really makes them important is that they recontextualize culture. They take inspiration and information and creativity from one area and put it into another area.
See, I mean, that to me is fascinating, you know, having kind of worked and written quite heavily about the role of art history, for example, or design history or fashion. And I think, you know, having had a decade where studying, I guess, things very specifically was almost dismissed because we wanted people to be general and we didn't trust experts and we were not keen to have, you know, somebody talk about the science of X or Y. And now suddenly I'm beginning to see across the culture this reinvestment in the expert and the specialist and somebody who has a very profound knowledge of particular things rather than general things. Do you think that's a trend that's getting bigger? You know, I'm thinking, for example, you know, during the whole kind of COVID epidemic, we looked to experts. The issues about climate catastrophe, we're looking to experts and to science. We're returning back to identify with the factual rather than the fantastic. Do you see that as a kind of a major emerging trend that we should pay attention to?
Well, I mean, like, expertise in a specific area, sure. But when you think, I mean, I'm going to take you a little bit further from where you are, because I don't think it's that linear. An expert in one area like science doesn't have the same weight as expert in music. I mean, one is saving lives, the other is helping you spend your afternoon in a pleasant way, you know. So what we have as curators is basically that helping consumers navigate to a mess of information, which you what you think that experts also do. It's like simplify and contextualize. But again, more importantly, curation is a form of creativity, because the way you put things together and the way the mix and new context that's created, that's how culture evolves.
So it is, yeah. I suppose the romantic in me always thinks that we will end up going back to that age of enlightenment, you know, where we will look at kind of the factual world, the poetic world, the academic world, the psychic world, and pull them all together and not see any distinctions between, you know, saving the planet or saving our soul. So I kind of feel that maybe there's a way forward for that in the future. I mean, one of the things that actually occurred to me when I was reading your book is, and I guess this, I'm asking you to wear your sociologist hat as well as your strategist hat and your CMO hat, is that we used to talk about brands as entity. You know, you refer to them as it. And then suddenly we now are seem to be talking, you know, in a personal people-based sense. We see them as personalities. We talk about having conversations with them. We talk about, you know, the brand having a voice, et cetera, et cetera. Why do you think that has come about?
Well, did the brands act like people?
Yeah, that we, and also I guess as consumers, we seem to regard them as people. I remember once when I started writing about brands in the 80s, it was always it, you know, we talk about brands in terms of it, not in terms of them or people, where now we talk about brands, or increasingly I hear people talking about brands like their best mates or their best friends, and they see them as people rather than necessarily, you know, kind of corporate entities.
I think that's been going on for a while, ever since the social advent of social media, because the brands that, I mean, I know it's a long process, so not everyone got it right, you know, from a get-go. Right. But the thing is really, like, when you are on Instagram, you can't just like put your campaign out there. I mean, like, who cares? It's more about, like, again, addressing those different audiences that you have, observers and the fans and the commentators, collaborators, and speaking to all of them. And for that, there is really need to have a value system and a tone of voice that reflects it. So that is important, to have that consistency. The moment you have a tone of voice, that is a human trait. That's one. Second thing that happened is there are a lot of influencers who became brands. So you have, is Rihanna a brand or a person? Well, she's both.
Yeah.
And the way they talk, and the way what is the conversation in social media, on TikTok and everywhere, it's very one-on-one conversation at scale, if you will, because when the medium changed, so did the tone of voice, so did the way we communicate. When it's a mass media, you have very impartial conversation because it goes in the ether, it's widely broadcasted. But when you deal with, when people deal with people, it's necessarily the conversation changes.
Perfect. And I guess, you know, to your point, you're then entering the realm of community, and, you know, that sits alongside conversation. And one of the phrases you use quite a lot in the book, which again really impressed me, was this notion of taste communities. What do you mean by taste communities in the context of how you've written about it in your book?
Yeah, taste communities are communities of people who share same or similar taste. So they're linked by that shared taste. And here, the most important and critical distinction is that I'm not talking about good taste and bad taste.
Right.
I'm not talking about upper class and lower class and who uses China when they eat and who, you know, who wears like whatever sneakers. It's about how taste is developed and evolved, and how those communities create a specific language around that taste. It's about taste as being as an activity, that activity that's constantly exercised, that is refined, that is tested, and that is also displayed and evolves nonstop. When you think about community of, say, coffee aficionados, So they non-stop, they read the magazines, they go to blogs online, they follow Instagram accounts, they're on TikTok watching videos, there are how-to videos on YouTube. Like, that's how you refine your taste. It's not given. It's something that you constantly need to refine. And in that sense, those communities, that's how taste is created as well as sort of displayed.
I guess also because people tend to think of taste in terms of lifestyle, but I think in your book you make it clear that it can be like a social movement, political, cultural. Because I think, you know, if you think about Me Too and you think about kind of Black Lives Matters, in some ways these are communities that have absolutely had huge influence and power, while, you know, if you think about in previous iterations, we've had feminism, we've had those debates going from you know, the 20s through to the 70s to the 90s, and they never seem to gather momentum in the way that suddenly where things like Me Too and you know, Black Lives Matter, because they were connected and because they operated like a community or an ecosystem, seem to have so much power. I mean, do you think that's the way forward with when we look at what's happening in you know, social media and in the culture generally, that the community wave will be the thing that carries thing rather than the individual voice? Or is that just a kind of a trend we're seeing at the moment and that will change, let's say, in 5 or 10 years?
Well, we are always part. We always reflect and the group we are part of. So we are never, individuals are not the core unit of marketing, of culture, of society. It's our connections, our relations, and who are we influenced by and who we influence. So looking at individuals for either marketing targeting or communication targeting or social change is just not a realistic way of communication or even on or making any impact, because we are communities we belong to, and we at the same time belong to multiple communities at the same time, and we play different roles in those communities. And we have different sources of influence, and we influence differently in those communities. So community is really a new unit of marketing, if you will. And I think it's always been the unit of social change, the unit of culture, and so on.
I agree. It's interesting talking to CMOs recently. You know, that's the most used term I've heard, like communities next to purpose, next to resilience, next to sustainability. And really that would kind of take me, because I'm just aware of our time of the podcast at the moment, it kind of takes me just to a couple of last questions. One of them being, as I always ask guests, what are the trends that you are seeing incoming that you believe will be the most impactful over the next 3 to 5 years in the marketplace?
In terms of culture, in terms of society, in terms of brand building, in terms of in what sense?
I guess in terms of kind of lifestyle. If I'm now like a major brand looking at the things I need to prepare myself for, the conversation I may need to have with my consumers, the thought leadership I need to be putting out into the market, or the things I need to be, you know, considering in terms of my communications arsenal, what are the trends that you would feel I need to have a sight line on so I can adjust my brand accordingly?
Well, I'm not a trend forecaster, I'm a sociologist. So I can tell you what I do think that brands need to do is that they need to look inward. They need to understand if their organization is set up for the present, forget about the future, for the present. Is their value chain reflecting the environment that they operate in? Not literally environment just in terms of environmental values, but the entire economic context, supply, distribution, all of that. So we are still operating in 20th century when it comes to organizations. So I would say organizational restructuring and rethinking is something that needs to happen. The second thing that needs to happen is really understanding the talent and resources people don't want to work somewhere for 15 years. They don't want to work somewhere for 5 years. They don't want to retire at the same company. I mean, that's been true for a while. So it's a completely different contract that you have with the talent and the companies, and especially now with the remote work and distributed work. You're not going back to the office in the same way. Like, yes, companies can pressure for that, but the workforce, the new workforce, the kids who are coming from college, they're not interested in sitting at their desk from 9 to 5, as they shouldn't be. So that is something that I'm thinking a lot about. It is what is really the future of work. And then the other thing is that I'm thinking about a lot is, how are we going to separate ourselves from our physical world? And how are we going to start signaling our status through NFTs, through different ways of value exchange, different ways of status symboling, different ways of accruing wealth? So that is something that's out there still, but it's very relevant at how much, and when you think about your strategy, you really invest of, like, do you really want to create that many products? Is growth really tied to production, to mass production, creating more crap? Or is, you know, or is inefficiency and degrowth the aspiration? And then how do you create value when you don't have growth as at all costs as your target? So I just recently wrote, actually, I think it's in my, no, I wrote it last April, but I republished it again, about degrowth as aspiration. So that is something I'm thinking a lot about as well, how to create value without creating more stuff, more.
Wow, you see, I you say you're not a forecaster, but I think you have given me, you know, some of the key thoughts, which when I sit and listen to CEOs or have conversations with them, that's the things that we are talking about and the things that you mentioned that they need to consider for the future. And we have run out of time. So I wish to thank you for such a brilliant ongoing insight about the culture, you know, about community, you know, taking your sociologist viewpoint and applying it to bigger aspects of the culture, which I think you do brilliantly in your book. And to be fair, I read it as a forecaster, reading some fantastic insights about forecasts. So either, you know, you can take it as a hugely eye-opener to what's happening, you know, in terms of the social fear about brands, but actually to look at the future and to read Anna's book, I think is really a good way to do it. The book is called The Business of Aspiration. That's how social, cultural, and environmental capital changes brands. It is, of course, available on Amazon and also at Good Booksellers. I bought two copies, just to let you know. One arrived from America, it took 4 days, and one arrived from London, which took 2 weeks. So I'm not quite sure that what that's telling us about the market, but you can find more about Anna's ideas and her works and even subscribe to her newsletter at Angelica. So it's angelicaaa.com. So you can find her newsletter there, find more about her thoughts. So in the meantime, saying goodbye to everybody, keep looking, keep listening, and of course, keep asking about what's new and what's next. Thank you.